TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
This is a story about corn, the sacred grain of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, one of the gifts at the first Thanksgiving feast at Plymouth, Massachusetts, and of modern-day corn that has been genetically engineered to kill insects and butterflies, of genetically engineered corn that the U.S. has a hard time selling abroad because nobody wants it in Europe, and that we all eat more of because it is so hard to sell abroad. A story about corn that is the second most important grain on this planet after rice. Corn that feeds people and animals and is an ingredient in most processed foods. And a story about the cradle of corn, of Zapotecan Indians who have cultivated corn from grass and tended it for over 10,000 years, through droughts and war, from generation to generation, in an unbroken link. The story begins in October of 2000, when scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, helped set up the first indigenous lab to analyze the pure corn of the Zapotecan Indians. What they found shook the world, made headlines in major European papers, brought UN conferences to a halt, and left the Zapotecan Indians with a deep sense of betrayal. The tests showed that the cradle of corn, the center of biodiversity, had been invaded by genetically modified varieties. It showed that a product of a biotech lab in the U.S. will show up in remote mountains in Oaxaca, even though the Mexican government forbids the planting of engineered corn. And it was not just a question of weeding out the offending plants. A virus used in plant genetics had inserted itself into the genome of some of the ancient corn. The scientists who made the discovery were Ignacio Chapela, assistant professor at the Department of Environmental Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and his grad student, David Quist. They worked for a year to verify their results, and in November 2001, the renowned science magazine of record, Nature, published the report. The biotech industry hired a PR company to discredit the research. The campaign was initially so successful that Ignacio Chapela feared that this would be the end of his career. On the other hand, public interest has not only kept the issue alive, but has grown over time. Chapela's nephew in Mexico told him recently that his name now turns up more entries in an internet search than a famous pop star. A book is being written and European TV has covered it. In the U.S., however, the story is still quite unknown. This story of corn, as told by Ignacio Chapela, also raises deep philosophical questions about the interaction of humans and nature over time. Chapela says that we are really changing the biosphere and the face of the earth, and the challenge is for us to comprehend changes that are invisible and yet so profound that they affect all of us and our children and children's children everywhere. Three friends and I met with Ignacio Chapela in the back of a Berkeley bookstore and sat in almost casual conversation to hear his story of corn. We began by asking Ignacio Chapela to take us to the Zapotecan village in Oaxaca, where the story began. Here's Ignacio Chapela, assistant professor for microbial ecology at UC Berkeley.
This region is a place that has a very long history, at least going 10,000 years back, where we know corn was domesticated and where people have kept corn going for all these thousands of years despite all kinds of challenges. They have always managed to maintain two things. One is their communal access to the land and management of those landscapes, and the other one is their communal access and management of the seed. We come into this story very, very recently, about 15 years ago. But by that I mean myself as well as other people that I collaborated with, mostly from Mexico City, but some people from abroad, because people around there are very conscious that they need to keep up with management of the resources in as good a way as possible. And they were asking questions about microbes. They were asking questions about things that one cannot see. And at that point, we started building up a lab, training people, incorporating this capacity into what they already have as a very well-established capacity to do management of plants, management of animals, and other things that you can see. And it was in this context that we started thinking from our knowledge here in the U.S. that we are releasing all these transgenic organisms into the environment. We started, suspecting that we would see, sooner or later, we would see contamination, pollution of the local land races of their crop with industrial varieties. And so we decided in my lab here in Berkeley to go there and try to help set up monitoring capacity. The way we did it was by sending David Quist, my graduate student, down with some positive controls, that is corn from cans from the supermarket here. And then he was planning to look at the local land races of corn as negative controls, thinking, if there is a place that we think of as pristine and far away and well-kept and so on, this is it. So we should not have contamination there. We also knew that the Mexican government had established a moratorium, a ban on the planting of transgenic corn, so we thought that there shouldn't be anything like that in Mexico in general. But at the same time, many people had been raising the question that transgenic material can move from industrial crops through pollen and through other means into places that should not be expected. So we went prepared to set up the foundation for the monitoring capacity so that in 5, 10, 15 years or whatever, whenever the contamination came, we would be ready to see it. Because in contrast with chemical pollution or chemical contamination, genetic contamination you cannot see. You cannot detect really readily with the naked eye. So you have to be prepared. You have to be looking. Otherwise, you don't see it. And that's one of the big tragedies about it, because you can have massive transformations of the biosphere without, if you're not trained, if you don't have the capacity to look for it, you just don't see it. Everything looks green. Everything looks growing. And yet it is vastly changed. So David goes there. He prepares a workshop. Many people are interested. They're going to show up the following day, but he's very conscious, and he sets up a trial run at night to check that everything is running fine and so on. So he calls early in the morning. I'm here in Berkeley, and he wakes me up, and he says, Ignacio, there is a little problem here. The workshop will start in about 2 hours, and I'm getting all these negative controls showing positive. What should I do? And it was a difficult question, because what do you do when you have to break the news to a group of people who hardly know what transgenics are? And besides, you cannot be really 100% sure. My immediate reaction was to say, David, I think that it might be contamination. You might have some false positives there. So I would not hide anything from anybody. I would run exactly the same samples and develop it, so to speak. But I would also not make much bones about it. I would not make a scandal out of it until we're really sure about it. This is October of 2000. We spent months up until March of 2001 running all kinds of confirmations and controls and reruns and everything to make sure that we were right. Of course, we knew this would be a scandal, not as big as it has become. We really never thought it would be quite so big. But we knew it would be scandalous, as it should have been. So we tried to make sure that everything was in place. And then we submitted the paper to Nature. At that point, really, it was the point where everything started snowballing. The whole dynamics of the scientific establishment started kind of getting tremors about it. Something that's, I think, really important about the story is that we are quite illegitimate. I am not a plant molecular biologist. David isn't either. The discovery was done by in a laboratory that's owned and run by a coalition of indigenous communities. So it was just totally off the radar from the main establishment. And that, to this day, I think, is the main thrust of why there is this incredibly rapid attack on the discovery. I've been to meetings sometimes where people say, oh, but, you know, they bang on the table and they say, I've been in this field for 25 years or 40 years or whatever, and I would never, ever have done that. And, I mean, it speaks for itself that somebody who has been in the field for so long and had never asked this question and had never dared look should be out. You know, it should not be. There's something wrong with the field if the field is not doing that. And I don't think it is coincidental that the discovery was made from outside the field.
Now, I understand that if you look at the genetic structure of a corn plant, it's fairly unambiguous to discover if it has been engineered because of certain markers in it.
Yes, that's right. Providing evidence of contamination is very straightforward. That's something that has been lost through the debate about this in the last few months, although it's being recovered, I think, as you are doing here. The discovery of contamination has never been challenged. The picture is very clear. It was clear with our very limited sample, and it has been clear for anybody who has looked. And there have been at least 5 independent rounds of looking. So anybody who has looked has found much higher levels of contamination than we found in Oaxaca. But apparently that's not enough for people to pay attention to it.
Can I ask you a question, Ignacio? Can you speak to the cultural implications of the discovery, of your discovery, among the Oaxacans for whom the idea of the contamination of corn will be something profoundly important, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a question that has troubled me from the beginning about this. Even coming into the field of corn in Mexico is something that is really daunting. Of course, you know, Mesoamerican cultures are the cultures of corn. There are the myths of creation in these cultures are always associated to corn. According to one of those myths, the Aztecs apparently, I understand, have this chronology of creations. There have been many stages of creations, and I think this is the 5th, or I can't remember the number, of creational round, and this is the age of corn. All the world that we are living in is the world of corn, and it will go under and something else will come, but right now it's the world of corn. So there are really massive and very deep cultural implications to the discovery of pollution. The concept of pollution and contamination from the outside world, from the U.S., from industrial hybrids and so on, was there. People, meaning the campesinos in the mountains, have been aware of this for a long time. But the discovery of this transgenic thing that has attracted reporters from the international community, TV crews, and it just seems to be such a big scandal, makes it much more dramatic what they already knew. People are very concerned, more than anything, because they were never told. They know that this is something that is done upon them, that these are changes, transformations of this very important part of their lives that were caused and created by someone outside. And there is this feeling of outrage at the fact, at the realization that this is true. At the same time, they're not victims. I mean, they're not in the victim role normally, like some other indigenous groups in Mexico might be. They're survivors. As I said before, they're survivors of thousands of years. So they're also using this to underscore and support their plight that they have been talking about for at least a century, which is the problem that they face when they are inserted into an international trade community. There is a real, very direct connection between me as a taxpayer, here in the Bay Area, how that money goes to support or hardly support a farmer in the Corn Belt of the U.S. to do soil mining, to do water mining, to do environmental mining in the sense that they do agriculture that ends up killing the mouth of the delta of the Mississippi and so on, to produce this underpriced, subsidized corn to be dumped into the international market, and my money as a taxpayer continues to flow in the international market, goes into Mexico as contaminating corn, finds its way to the deepest and most remote parts of the country, and gets to this place where the campesino is facing the decision of what seed to put in the ground. At that point, they are faced with the decision of putting in seed that they have to pay, they have to subsidize themselves from their pocket to be able to plant, or the seed that is being distributed and provided to them from the federal government stores. And many people do the, you know, what an economist would do, an economist here would say is the rational thing. They would take the cheaper seed and put it in the ground. They continue planting that, but it's not good enough. It ends up being unsatisfactory. Many people are moving out from the land. Many of these agricultural lands are being let fallow or reforested. And these people are finding their way back to California as, you know, domestic workers or agricultural laborers. And then you have this circuit closed from me here with my tax money to those people who end up coming here too. In between, you have the biological reality of this pollution of corn and the loss of the diversity of this very important crop that we as humanity are losing as we speak. There is the almost mythical cultural consequences of the contamination that really resonate very deep, and I really believe this is not going to go away in Mexico. This might overturn a president, overturn a whole regime. I think corn can be the thing, the lever that can really fire people up to do something about what's happening. And beyond that, there are also the cultural implications of our survival as humanity, that humanity that has been based, whether we like it or not, whether we recognize it or acknowledge it or not, on agriculture.
I just taped somebody named Andres Barreda. He said that with NAFTA, war began in Mexico on the indigenous peoples, and that the war for liberation of indigenous peoples was bound up with their resistance to what he called biodevastation.
Yeah, it is very clear that it's not about money. I talked before about how the econometrically rational decision for a campesino in Mexico is to stop planting their own corn. In fact, to stop planting corn altogether. And this is exactly what the economists in Mexico City have done explicitly, very explicitly and repeatedly have said, we need to get these people out of the land. If they cannot compete in the international market, they need to move out. Go into the city, die, whatever, but they're not economically viable. They should move out. So the very fact that there is corn being planted, that there is indigenous land races of corn still on the ground and still growing, is, I think, a testimony to the really severe limitations of this econometric analysis, for one thing. But more than that, much more important, is a real testament to the fact that people move by other reasons, from other sources. They will do things that you would not be able to model with an econometric modeling effort, like maintaining this crop on the land.
I had always wished I'd meet somebody, and now you're here, who can describe to me what it looks like there. You know, how remote it is, and how many varieties of corn still are carefully tended there. That's like over 100, I understand.
I haven't been to India. I haven't been to Ethiopia or Turkey. I really want to go to those places, but I imagine they must be like this. China, I've seen pictures of the Yunnan province in China, and it looks like this. And I think the thing that really strikes me from all these different places in the centers of diversity in the world is that, is the enormous diversity, the sheer difference that you find from one spot to the other. It just hits you with diversity at every corner. The other thing that all these areas have in common is that there is no way that you can think of these areas as devoid of people. These, the diversity that you see in plants, that you see in soils, that you see in altitudes and exposures, and how the wind is blowing, and whether this wind has water or not in it, and whether it is exposed to frost or not, and so on. All this diversity you see in people, too. These are people who have been there for very long, and they have taken from the diversity of the land, or they have just grown into it in such a way that there is no way you can separate what's human and what's non-human. Every time that an expert, an ecologist, comes to a place and does a study, they discover that many of the species that you find in a place, even though it might look really remote, and you know there are monkeys and there are toucans and there are all kinds of wonderful birds and other animals flying around. But no matter how remote it looks and how wild, every time you look, you can see the footprint of human manipulation, of human interaction, even the most remote places. And the same way the other way around. People who live there have been... you cannot see them as separate from the non-human. In this corn, for example, in this case, for example, the corn makes a very, very strong link between that non-human and human spheres. Yeah, that translates into color and into sound and, you know, scent and all kinds of very sensual things that these landscapes have.
You know, people who go there in order to find varieties that are almost extinct or not known, they probably look at it as a place of treasure. Wasn't that the first impetus of people who were looking for the disappearing relations to the industrialized corn that we need to protect in order to protect even the horrendous monocultural corns, because they will be vulnerable unless they get infusions from wildness?
That's actually right. When the corn blight in the 1970s and then again in the 1980s hit the U.S., all these stories came out that, scientists saw this happening, saw the blight coming, and they just ran to Mexico, to Oaxaca, and they just grabbed genes from there and put them quickly into the corn, the industrial corn, and then the next year's harvest was saved. You know, that's a story you'll see in the newspapers. But the reality is that that's not the way it happens. Again, the times of living things are very different from the times of chemical things or nuclear accidents and so on. The maintenance of an agricultural system, whether it is the one that we're mostly fed from here, which is industrial agriculture, or the one that campesinos in that area, in those areas in Oaxaca, are fed from, those systems are really supported by long-term processes. So the introduction of genes, of genetic material from Oaxaca to U.S. hybrids, or international hybrids in Africa or wherever you want to find them, and this applies for all crops, this introduction is something that takes a very long time. So the genes that saved the U.S. corn harvest in the 1970s from the blight were genes that were introduced maybe 15 years before, where the breeders didn't know what they were doing. They were not expecting anything specific, but they were maintaining this diversity in their lines for the eventuality of a challenge like that, like the corn blight. And, you know, it worked. But it can only work as long as you have that basis of diversity and as you keep this dynamic of interaction with it, many people wrongly believe that by taking the seeds from these areas and putting them in vaults, like we have in places like the Center for Research and Improvement of Corn and Wheat in Mexico City or Fort Collins and Iowa here in the U.S., many people believe that by putting seeds into these vaults, we can save that diversity and just have it as a bank account, so to speak, where we could draw from. And that, of course, is totally wrong. You have to keep these things alive, and you have to keep them alive long term. And the only way to keep crop variety alive is to keep people alive who are relating to this diversity. It applies to corn, it applies to rice, it applies to wheat and sorghum and potatoes and whatever you want. It's theoretically impossible to come up with a system that would support the diversity per se, the living diversity per se, other than having humans interacting with the crops. Even the very destructive industrial agriculture that we have, we must maintain that diversity down there. And when we are confronted with an unsolvable problem, we will just simply will not have the resources to confront it. That's it.
That was Ignacio Chapela, Assistant Professor of Microbial Ecology at the University of California, Berkeley. He wrote a report for the science magazine of record, Nature, on the contamination of the Zapotecan corn in Oaxaca, Mexico. Unprecedented in its over 100-year history, and apparently pressured by a huge campaign by the biotech industry, the magazine tried to make him retract his findings. Chapela and his grad student, David Quist, stood by their work. The findings were confirmed by other labs. This was part one of a one-hour story of corn recorded in the back of a bookstore where I had invited a few of my friends to take part in the conversation. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Ignacio Chapela on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this conversation with Ignacio Chapela by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.